This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I'd like to say that it's a real pleasure and honor to be discussing with the author this remarkable book. And I brought here something that may look a little irrelevant, but that has a lot to do. It's maybe not the latest issue of Elle, but it's quite typical. Stress test. Are you doing too much? And you have then two pages, and I was expecting to see something like a test, but it's really an article about stress. But I think in Elle, we are used to these things every week. What is to test oneself? Do we do too much? We do, of course. And when I first saw this book, I have to say I didn't really understand the title. I thought it was The Driving Test or Test Drive. And then I realized that it was a book that opened, as Avital's books always do, onto a series of interconnected questions. Torture, love, psychology, philosophy, Nietzsche. There's a biography of Nietzsche contained in this book. And what we want to do tonight is more a freewheeling discussion. Avital just said that after she's published a book, she suffers from hysterical amnesia. She doesn't remember what she's written. And so this will be our task first tonight, just to make her remember slowly what she has penned in those pages. And I'd like perhaps to begin with one question. That is, at some point, Avital, you say that testing is a para-concept. And could you, in a way, explain what you mean by the connections between all these levels of philosophy, science, and, well, let's say, psychological tests of everyday life?
Thank you. And when will Eduardo speak? when
he wants.
Just asking. So do I...
You should start.
So this feels like a pop quiz. But first of all, let me thank all of you from, is it the heart of my bottom or the bottom of my heart, for inviting me, for taking time to help present a book that has somehow been disavowed by me for some reasons that I'd be very honored to share with you. Thank you for taking time from your work and to do some work here with me, and perhaps you'll want to contribute to our conversation. But this book obviously came out, and it's dedicated to Jacques Derrida. And I was tested to my limit because I had the privilege of spending the last 8 months of his life with him, doing Californian kinds of rituals, visualizations, meditation. At one point he was in a very bad mood, I'd say, and he didn't want to do meditation, and he said, "Meditation for me is Descartes, so leave me alone today." So he didn't want to meditate with me on that day. But one of the things that I had to contend with was, would I show him the galley proofs or not? Because I obviously wanted to show him this book. I wanted him to see it. I wanted him to see that I was trying to honor parts of his work, that he was very crucial to the trajectories I'm trying to establish here, and that he was my training camp. I really wanted him to see that, but I realized that if I showed him the galleys and the very last stages before it became a book, then he would know, because we're cabled to each other according to all sorts of paranoid codes, he would know that I think he wasn't going to make it. So I had to convene with myself and say, honey, can you take it if he never sees this? And I thought it was hard, but I got past that, so he never saw it. And that for me is a kind of it's clearly a narcissistic wound that's hardly the greatest problem with his disappearance, but it means that something happened to this book that it just wouldn't appear. I'm kind of in disavowal of it, and so thanks to you, Aaron, and Eduardo and Jean-Michel, this is the first time I can even look at it. And I wanted you to know that, and I want to thank you for co-piloting this kind of moment, obviously somewhat pathos-filled, and I hope it doesn't make you want to puke, but it's very heartfelt. It's a difficult thing to somehow let this book start to have its own itinerary, and I think that can happen here. So thank you very much for that. By paraconcept testing, 1, 2, 3, is something that is very hard to designate or limit or philosophically to pin according to any classical taxonomy or definition or grid that we would recognize. And yet I wanted to work with it without reducing it to a theme or a topos, nor assuming that it had the stature or status of a concept. It didn't even have that kind of, let's say, musculation. So I wanted to work it in a certain way, but according to the way we work with and the protocols with which we work concepts. So I called it a paraconcept, so that it could simulate a concept, but then that would have to drop off all of the grandiosity of a concept or the Kantian, let's say, explicitness of the conceptual. The testing, even though it seems to be ubiquitous and in your face and on your case all over the place, anytime you want to test out or test in or testify, which is linked to testing, into any institution or space, or even if you consider the definition of the human or post-human or replicants and even Blade Runner, that archaic film at this point, everything gets determined and gets definition through testing in a certain way. So at once it's all over the place, it's everywhere, you can't really bypass or evade what I'm calling the test drive. At the same time, it hasn't been philosophically, it's flown beneath philosophical radars. Even though everyone and everything gets tested, is tested, you can't even go on a date unless the other has been tested, and so on and so forth. So there's a kind of, let's say, high frequency and pressure zone into which testing can be inserted, and yet it hasn't been a philosophical question. It hasn't been, and yet testing is the question of the question. In French, question also means torture. So in this book, I'm interested in torturing, or as we could say, worrying the subject, like boring into probing, testing knowledge and so on, and so it functions not as a concept because it won't stop its disseminative run. I'll just stop my disseminative run right here and let Eduardo take the floor, as it were.
Well, I wasn't exactly ready to take it, but I'll take it. And I also would just like to begin by thanking all of you for being here, and thanking Aaron and Jean-Michel for inviting us and making this event possible. I will say one of the things that I was listening to as you were speaking. I mean, you were talking about the way in which testing, it's some level belongs to the signature of philosophy. I mean, it's something that is already part and parcel of the philosophical project. Philosophy is a kind of mode of testing. And when you said that testing is also a means whereby we arrive at definitions, et cetera, one of the things that I registered in reading the text as well is that you talk about the way in which testing actually works on a double register, so that on the one hand, it is there to provide definition, to calculate, to count on the other, to affirm a certain confidence, but at the same time, it also deprives us of the confidence, right? It also, it legitimates and corroborates, but it also delegitimates and questions, so that at the same time that testing is a means of definition, it's also a means of questioning and unsettling definitions. And I think that's whether you're discussing the trial of experience, as you say, whether you're talking about tests of loyalty, friendship, love, our humanity, our faith and convictions, the role and place of tests within the medical, political, philosophical, religious, or academic domains. In each instance, it seems to me that one of the things you do is you pay attention not only to the relations between testing and torture, but also to this double register of testing, the way in which testing itself tests itself. There's a way in which testing, as you say, operates relationally at one moment. One of the things that I also would, and maybe this is moving a bit too quickly, I mean, there were a number of things that I would like to talk about in terms of what you convey in the text, but what I wanted to also talk about, and this is something that I think belongs not just to what makes this book what it is, but also something that belongs to the signature of your work, and something that I've always valued in your work, which has to do with the way in which, at least as I've experienced the work, that there's always an effort on your part to enact and perform within the very movement of your writing what you wish to convey. And so that in the same way that you talk about Nietzsche's Gay Science as a test site, as already a test site, I think there's a way in which your own book, The Test Drive, is a kind of test site, which is testing your own relation to these different traditions, be they philosophical, psychological, etc. But one of the things that I wanted to ask you to think about, and maybe this would be one thread that one could follow, as I was thinking about the construction of the book, and because my antennas are always up for references to Emerson, one of the things that I registered is that, of course, this focus on Nietzsche's Gay Science, the title Gay Science comes from Emerson's essay, Poetry and the Imagination, where he talks about poetry as a gay science. And I'll ask something later about the role and place of literature within this deliberation on testing and so on. But one of the things that you say about Nietzsche's Gay Science is that it presents itself as a book, as a test site, and one of the registers of its being a test site is the fact that there are multiple prefaces to it. There are multiple beginnings. I mean, it keeps testing how it's going to begin, how it's going to proceed. And the book, The Test Drive, actually begins with multiple epigraphs. There are sort of references to Rilke, to Hölderlin, to Emerson, and these seem to me to be a way to stage the beginning of the test as a kind of, the text as a kind of test site. And when I was thinking about this beginning with Emerson, the first part of the book, one of the things that I recalled is that, of course, Emerson's essays on fate and history were Nietzsche's own first test site for his thinking about the concept of the eternal return, because his first scribblings and notations on that concept, he writes them in the margins of his copies of Emerson's book, Fate and History. And one of the things that you also mention in relation to Nietzsche is that Nietzsche thought of America itself as one of the privileged test sites, and there's a way in which America was always figured as a site of experimentation, a site of trial, and so on. And as you point out, after 9/11, George Bush referred to the fact that we're now the nation is being tested. And I was thinking about the role and place of, the thread that one could follow from Emerson, Nietzsche, America, America as the test site, in relation to much of the discussion that you have within the book about the links between democratic institutions and testing and torture, which seem to me very relevant today. But I don't know if this is a beginning, I mean, something that you can start improvising on. But I think one of the things that I wanted to say, and this is just to go back to what I was beginning with, is the way in which, in the construction of the book itself, not just in terms of the form of the book, the improvisations within the book. I mean, if some of you have looked at the book, or even if you haven't, there are moments when Avital ventriloquizes different philosophers. There's a section where Husserl speaks for many pages, and he talks about his encounter with her, and so on. So there are these moments that are extremely performative, and what I wanted to register is at least one thread of that performance in connection to the link between Emerson and Nietzsche. Emerson being a figure for the multiple beginnings, I mean, whether it's Rilke, Hölderlin, and of course one link between Hölderlin and Emerson is that, like Hölderlin, who already announced the withdrawal of the gods, Emerson also thought that the word God was as fugitive as any other word, so that there are these resonances that one could track in relation to the multiple epigraphs, which kind of, in a Promethean way, foresee what's to come.
Thank you.
One thread.
Thank you. You do me great honor. Thank you very much. Thank you. Do you want to say anything? Or shall I begin? Well, that didn't work. I want to thank you very much. I'm very. There's something humiliating about actually feeling that one is being read. There's the usual sense of writing in extreme and glacial landscapes of solitude, where you say to yourself, either you're following the ideology of who cares as you're doing this kind of work, or no one's going to read it anyway. But now this is a kind of call that one does want to respond to, however. So thank you for the time and thoughtfulness that you cast upon the work that I'm trying to do here. And I'll try to respond to some of the points that Eduardo made, though they're quite eloquent and quite far-reaching. Clearly, there are several registers, and one is a taking to task of, say, the scientific dominance or the sway of scientificity under which we live, not only in institutions where the scientists get pumped with money and the so-called humanities suffer a kind of toxic depletion, and so on and so forth. One of my subtitles, or imaginary subtitles, is Why Science Amazes Us. So clearly, I'm trying to read, let's say, a preeminent figure in scientificity, such as testability, the test, the figure of the test in all sorts of scientific protocols, and what I try to call the test tube grammatology, and certain kinds of metaphysical illusions and comforts that science still permits itself, and that states that are highly invested in and throw money at science blindly accede to. So there is a very serious critique of science, a la Emerson and Nietzsche, in which I throw open the dossier or the question of isn't science to be held responsible for producing, as Nietzsche said, galaxies of joy rather than this glacial, killer, deadening scientificity, which Husserl felt was a very severe type of objectivist alienation, and all of the scientific sites that are on the side of death and depletion and toxicity and so-called third world arsenals. So I'm very concerned about, let's say, the scientific sway which Lacan, in his Ethics of Psychoanalysis, also told us that taught us science is always on the horizon. It's always ready to explode or take us down. There's also that kind of science, and now I'm switching on the transvaluating machine, which is to say the Nietzschean need to affirm science, as we can see now in struggle with our is used loosely with the American government's anti-scientific, let's say, velocities against stem cell research and so on and so forth. So the Nietzschean, let's say, so to speak, even though it's very complicated and contradictory sounding, left-wing scientificity that insists on joyfulness, gaiety, and power politics that will out-politic, so to speak, politics, which is to say, Nietzsche puts science up against something like God, or something like theocracies and theologies that, as you must know, he found to be highly problematic and on the way out, ever on the way out. And that corpse of God is still stinking up the whole scene, according to Nietzsche. This isn't me, I'm just channeling my friend Friedrich, Nietzsche. So just imagine, with the current situation in America, where science is really, even though it's on the one hand itself all too powerful and problematic and institutionally overly enhanced, on the other hand, it's in a certain way, just positionally and structurally, fighting a certain kind of right-wing Christian attack zone, which we need to understand more carefully. So science, what Nietzsche says is that God always put a veto on science. God is terrified by science, and that's one of the starting engines for what I'm trying to do. I wouldn't be only interested being, and we've been friends forever, you know that. Of course, there's a theoretical stake in this question of what's the scientificity to which Nietzsche points us, and how can it be joyous, and what does Nietzschean joy mean in the most serious, alert, vigilant, responsible way? Because that's where I start pretending I'm Husserl, in a sense, because Husserl actually believed that we should have our heart and incredible vitality in thought, in philosophy, in science. This is the stuff that's supposed to, without having merely redemptive powers, this is supposed to turn us on and help us and get us out of real serious ruts of all sorts of determinations and levels. So one of my let's say adherences is to these highly philosophical or theoretically inflected questions, but that wouldn't turn me on. That wouldn't make me go or get out of bed or something. There's something about the scientificity that Nietzsche, in a very covert collaboration with Husserl and other philosophers, point to, including Kant, obviously, and cosmopolitanism, There's something deeply anti-racist about the test in a way that allowed me to find an access code, an untried access code to some of the mappings that we've been, all of us collectively, working on, whether or not it's conscious, whether or not it's passionate or even articulated. So the absence of the test, according to Nietzsche, when you're not testing your limits, when you're not testing hypotheses, first of all, the very switch and shift to a hypothetical relation to world is radical. As Derrida has shown in his reading of Judaity and Germanicity, which is to say the Reformation, which the German Reformation, which, or the, he puts the protest back in Protestantism, Derrida does. I want to put the test back in my Protestant background, okay? So, which is to say there's a perpetual rupture or perpetual protest going on with the test. The test initiates for Nietzsche and others a provisional logic, which is to say that it undermines itself, it's highly risk-taking, it scrambles the very master codes that it installs, it blows up in your face, and it has to start over. So it's a very, and this is why, this is too fast no doubt, but this is why it's on the side of the Reformation, a kind of anti-authoritarian para-concept, so to speak, because everything has to stand the test of time. No one can get away with bullshit. No racism, this is Nietzsche, no racism will be allowed to stand for more than 2 minutes if it's put to the test. It's just, these are lies. So for Nietzsche and the Reformation and all sorts of, let's say, armies of complicity that share a certain subterranean logic, once you have to put yourself or the other or any kind of posited veracity to the test, you have to be willing to give it up. And so there's a kind of humiliation that turns me on. I love the humiliated. I love those who get battered and tortured and have to get up again and try again. Nietzsche has a very nice image for that. He says, those who are courageous enough to go with the test are those who don't have to bow at the end of the day to his lordship and say, oh, I'm so ashamed I failed. So instead, there's a pride of failure. You know, I fucked up. I'm wrong. I rescind. So one of the para-concepts that I work with is rescindability. What does it mean to rescind what you thought might have been the truth? It really changes a lot, because if you're willing to rescind or take back or rewrite or die and collapse and try again. This is one of Nietzsche's Untergänge, his going under. So this, the eternal return is also a test. Dionysus is the god of the test. So I'm also trying to read, of course, in my paranoid, grandiose way, all of Nietzsche, all of phenomenology, and so on and so forth. But what interests me, and you're so right, Eduardo, to point to the double register, which is that the test is something that corroborates, I mean, or deprives us of confidence in the world. And that kind of movement, which is always tremulous and uncertain, is something that I try to be attentive to. I was trying to mark certain moments of the way the test delegitimates. Okay, so I am asking the test to work in service of a certain political kick-ass attitude, or Einstellung, as Husserl would say. And then I try also to consider different modulations of testing, such as when one says, so this is typical, I think, of what I've been doing, which is to work with what's called high theory, but also colloquialisms. Like, what does it mean when someone says, try me? You know, try me. That's inviting the other to test a limit. So that's also a threat that interests me. But of course, I'm very, very concerned with the risk-taking that testing demands and involves and invites, which is to say that you can lose everything by conceding to the test. But then there are other moments in itineraries, such as testing your love, testing your friendship. If it's truly love and truly friendship, should it even be tested? But what would be an absence of test? And when does a test take place? If you know it's a test, then it's not a test. If God had said to Abraham, okay, this is a test of the emergency broadcast system. If this were a real test. But the thing is, as in Rousseau and elsewhere with Abraham, you can't know it's a test in the present. It's not present, and it doesn't offer presence in a certain very vital way. So there are a lot of complications as well. Now, you began with Emerson's essays. The very word essay, or the form of essay, is a test, is a trial. An essay in French, the word for testing or trying something out is an essay. So as in English, not quite contemporary perhaps, but an essay. I'd like to essay it. I'd like to try it out. So there's all sorts of, let's say, registers that I try to work with, the trial runs, essays, and so on and so forth. So that would be the beginning of a response. Obviously, the question of democracy is greatly at stake for us today, and it's very perverse to have Nietzsche step up to the plate to help us think democracy, but precisely because it's perverse and there's absolute incompatibility between Nietzschean aristocratic disdain and the call for democracy, that Nietzsche has to be called to testify for us. Because, first of all, Nietzsche's ever splitting according to the transvaluations that he performs. There's a good democracy and a bad democracy, a wimpy, servile, docile, decadent democracy, which is to say the rule of the most idiotic, imbecilic, and puerile, which sometimes happens. And then there might be a more powered-up democracy that can be a test site that is not on the side of death and takes risks and is always at risk of dying off and withering, which is where we find ourselves with our baby and fragile democracy, as it turns out. That it's being tested right now, and can it survive? So Nietzsche pushes things to a place of survivability. Can our democracy survive? For democracy to be at its peak, it has to question itself in this radical and tortured way all the time. It can't take itself for granted. It can't even claim to know what it is. It doesn't have an essence, in a sense, but it has this really troubled and anxious relation to its own limits, which are never secured or assured, I think.
Yeah, I love what you just said, Avita. And in order to try and flatter you,
it always works.
I'd say that, to me, there are two powerful readings of Nietzsche. One, both are very critical. One is Heidegger's reading of Nietzsche when he tries to show that Nietzsche believes is the radical collapse of metaphysics, whereas in fact he embodies the achievement of metaphysics. And then there is what you've been doing in this book, which is both, and I think Eduardo said that very well, to give us a sort of streetwise Nietzsche with tattoos and shaved head and sneakers and jeans, and American Nietzsche whistling some rock and roll tune and something like that. And that really comes alive wonderfully. But it is also a very serious philosophical book, and what I think you do is to give us a Husserlian Nietzsche, not at all a Heideggerian Nietzsche. That is a Nietzsche who is in fact obsessed with the question of science, which has never been done so radically, because after all, what did he know about science, Nietzsche? Probably philology, a bit of economics, politics, history. But what you show is that he's totally relevant for our culture, American culture, let's say, in which science is basically everywhere. And this is my last question, perhaps. I think you, and maybe you could say something about this, in the famous introduction to the attempt, when he republished The Birth of Tragedy, he wrote an attempt at self-criticism in which he said that he was trying for the first time to view science through the optic of the artist and art through the optic of life. This sentence has often been quoted. It's a little baffling. And I think your book makes sense of it in many, many ways by insisting, as you just did, on provisional solutions that can be reworked. Nothing is absolutely final. And this is something that science, after all, brings to us. We revise, as Nietzsche says, it's why should we happy to keep our convictions? It's better to change our convictions once in a while. But at the same time, we need to question the ideology of scientism or positivism as you do. And so could you say just a little more about this idea of viewing science through the optic of the artist?
Thank you. You're quite right, and we should point out that Nietzsche often takes himself down, denounces himself, as in his so-called autobiographical work or autothanatographical work or auto-OTO, as Derrida spells it, because it goes through the ear, the autobiography of Nietzsche. He takes himself down, he rips himself apart, and he is always testing himself and declaring his experiments, or in German, Versuch is related to Versuchung. So the test and the temptation are always merged in Nietzsche. But in any case, he's always disrupting himself in a very brave and courageous way and marking himself down. You're quite right, and he does so already in The Birth of Tragedy. Now, Nietzsche says and installs art in order to prepare us and inoculate us for science. Nietzsche claims that without art we would commit suicide, because art is preparatory to the scientific rigor that can really rip us apart. Now, what does that mean, this kind of cohabitation in which one succeeds the other that Nietzsche insists upon? Well, art takes us away from and pulls us away from the more theologically imprinted necessity for truth and all sorts of metaphysical comforts. Art already starts administering the drugs that we need to put up with science, because you've got to build your immune system in order to take on science, because science no longer is dependent on truth or falsity. Science, and this is why Nietzsche also had his night goggles on and saw what a disaster science and the experimental disposition, this is what he's writing about, Nietzsche, the experimental disposition in which America becomes an exemplary test site, not only because America is the land of all sorts of switches that can be made. Nietzsche, by the way, already predicted that that in the future, actors would become politicians in America. Precisely because America, and this for Nietzsche is not a put-down, the different masks, the different fictions of self-presentation are always propped up, and no one is pinned down to their essence or identificatory substance or pathos. Anyone in America can go under, hide, come up as a new person or being or figure. Anyone can be a jack of all trades. There are pre-Socratic plumbers in America and so on. He knew it all, but he also knew, so you had to get your immune system all ready for these kinds of switches that would multiply any kind of phenomenal being or any kind of role playing. He does discuss it in terms of role playing. In America was this place where anyone can take any role and any mask. Again, this is not bad for Nietzsche, because he wants to disrupt all of those really heavy assignments of identity that Europe was stuck with and kind of walking in concrete shoes. In America, you can do whatever you want and be whomever you want. But what that meant was that there's also a scary and altogether terroristic aspect of science, because it won't be held to some sort of supramoral responsibility. Here I'm thinking of Jean-Luc Nancy's work on Nietzsche and supra-morality, which is to say not just Kantian morality or the categorical imperative, but something else that's going on. What's going to hold science back? And this is a big issue about the atomic bombs. I don't have to remind you that Frankenstein monster remains the figure par excellence for the kind of runaway scientificity that is a killer machine, a serial killer machine. Science kills, because science is not beholden or doesn't need to account for itself, which again, you evaluate according to different Nietzschean perspectives. That's great. That's liberatory. That's amazing that there's this force that can just outrun any archaic hold of a moralistic sort. But then there's the truly troubling side of science, which Nietzsche, as I was beginning to say, with his night goggles, futural night goggles, could see. Now, the most radical experimental site were the concentration camps, where anything went, and there are still ethical debates about whether one can use the results from those experiments in the camps for contemporary scientific work. Because all sorts of experiments, as you know, were carried out there. So I don't try to disavow that this is part of the scientific drive. I try to, without being able to assimilate or understand, this is a trauma. This is a trauma that we share, that science also has a killer instinct. It won't be held back, and that there will be monstrous moments where it just cannot be made to stop itself. So these are questions and dossiers that I open. I don't pretend to have an answer, but I do claim that Nietzsche foresaw this and was already asking about the experimental disposition and what its extreme manifestations will become inevitably.
I think we want to open the discussion to the test of dialogue and your questions, if there are questions. So, anybody? Yes.
That's a very good question. My concern is that I wouldn't want this to be only a matter of productivity. Do you understand what I'm quarreling with there in the vocabulary is the productive. Because one of the downsides of science is that it overestimates production or productivity, but and then the other inevitable problem is the way testing rescores what we understand by failure. So there's an unstoppable deconstruction of what constitutes failure or so-called success, and what would be the temporal determination. You see what I mean? So that we wouldn't want failure to be the opposite of success anymore. Testing actually makes us rezone these kinds of questions, because even if you test to failure, but then failure itself turns around and becomes something else. And what is failure? It makes us ask that very question, but you're absolutely right on the modernist pulse to ask about, let's say, the proliferation of failure as a key premise for anything to happen or any event to somehow occur. So we wouldn't want to limit failure at all, but one has to really throw open all sorts of theoretical considerations. Thank you.
Chris?
So I thought, it was a quick reading that I did through the book, and I could not help but think on every page that it had a great deal to do with performance, not only the text, the construction of the text itself, but as a kind of performance theory sojourners. I mean, it seems that ontologically a lot of the questions about the sense of the text itself leading to almost a aporia that you can't get through. And then in the middle of it, you bring out the Zen master, and you sort of subvert the kind of stage. What is it? The Nietzsche subject is Nietzsche's thinker on the stage kind of notion that all of a sudden Nietzsche gets off the stage, and we have the Zen master walking through with the teachers, which then creates another question, which reverts back to another kind of Nietzsche, which is the contest in the work of tragedy and its revision against illusion, and that's where the theatrical notion. Positing itself again and again and again, that the illusion is thrown up, and you even use the notion of the dispersion and dismemberment before against the Apollonian whole, shining whole, that constitutes the kind of a relation in nature. So the question then becomes, though, at what point is this testing, and in all of these kinds, most even again in love, finally, again, the illusion and the self, and the self-delusion involves all this stuff. At what point does that sense of science also risk, or are not so much science in and of itself, but in the kind of positing of the testing, that it constantly risks being just disposed toward a kind of ontological sense of illusion, or maybe even kind of a Maya veil that is just never unwrapped, even with all of our morality, because it kind of steps, keeps on stepping back to us again and again. And we're stuck with that kind of thing. But that's the Simonia, the terror, the shaking Simonia there that Nietzsche asked. older paradigm again against the truth and illusion, and how do we kind of get out of that kind of process?
Okay, I'm not sure that. Now I feel you put a great responsibility on my shoulders when you said future of theory. I'm like, holy shit, the whole future of theory. I better, you know, and I froze.
I
can handle that, but the future of theory is at stake here. I think it's very certainly complicated, and I wanted to follow a kind of, you're absolutely right about certain staging moments, but also some testing devices or structures are sub-phenomenal, can't be seen. One of my questions is, concerns the subterranean logic of testing and how it affects us even as it constitutes what we still persist in calling a human being or a relation to world or world and so on and so forth. So, and I try to certainly differentiate. There are different stages. There's the pharmaceutical notion of testing. There's the drug sense of experimentation. And what Eduardo referred to as the literary as well. So there's certainly a lot going on, so much so that I wouldn't know if it could be thrown back to truth and illusion or any kind of binary mirroring. Because something gets cracked and broken and fissured, I think, with testing, and that's why I'm writing this. Sometimes it's like writing a wild beast in a rodeo. I do get thrown off and so on. And you're right, suddenly there's a Zen master. And the question there is focused on the koan. The question is, does Zen withdraw from the West test, or are all of those Eastern forms of terrific ascetic discipline and meditation and so on not in some ways participate in and redraw the map of what we think a test consists in a test? So there's so much ground that I'm trying to cover, including what it means to prove. What proving grounds are? Where do you supply proof? What is evidence? What constitutes evidence? So I do go into legal situations, and all of which do have a theater and a performance aspect. There's no doubt about it. But go ahead. But when I get done with it, it's not even clear what's east or west, right? Oh, you didn't finish it. I'm wondering what the hell you're talking about. Excuse me, no offense. No, but you didn't finish it?
No, I didn't.
Sorry. I apologize. No, but there's a moment in which one can no longer say that we can territorialize in certain ways. And there's constant contamination and also a kind of unconscious travel zone and itinerary of testing, let's say, from the Greeks, where the word bazanos covers both torture and the test. So, which is to say that one tortures, and I felt it was necessary to get back to a kind of history of torture, obviously, since we're now a torturing culture. We always were, but now it's sayable in some indecent loudspeaker way. So let's say it, let us say it, let us talk, let us reflect on what the history of torture is, and it's indissociable from the test. If torture is related to truth and testing, it's because it's thought that a body can be made to speak or to cough up the truth because it's being probed in according to certain very codified ways of approaching the body and so on and so forth. It was only on Aristotle in the Rhetoric that he said, you know, someone might say a falsity or produce a lie just to have the torture stop. This was a revolution in thought. That it's not necessarily absolutely connected to the truth. And yet, I've been trying to, on many, many, coming in from different approaches and runways, understand different, don't forget, and you're absolutely right, that this is also a questioning not only of staging, but the staging of philosophy. If philosophy is irrevocably linked to the question, because testing is a form of questioning. But I lost my thread here. I am trying to consider in all of the scenographies of testing and examination and interrogation, and to understand what kind of contaminations and overflows and factors continue to be carried on even in something as benign as the oral exam in a university, and the traces of torture, let's admit, that are involved in these kinds of hazings, and how they continue to travel from bazanos to the present, and the kind of premium that's placed on test situations. So what are these? Why are they still permitted to determine results and outcomes, even if they're inconclusive in certain discursive formations, and so on and so forth? Why are we hooked on the test? That would be one of the questions that a lot of my work has to do with addiction and technological addiction, and testing is also the kind of thrownness of technology. I try to say it's a technological invasion of the subject, if there's a subject. So there's a lot going on, I think.
Thank you.
Yeah, that's a. No, I'm kidding. No, this is one of the pressure zones that we're working with, right? Which is a hypothetical relation to world, and what kind of renunciation that might even imply. Could you imagine the Bushies and so on having a more hypothetical relation to things? And let's try this out. This is what Nietzsche demands, is that we try things out. He wants things tried out. And the thing, let's say the grammar of your question, who decides a hypothesis, is much different than who decides the truth or who decides some sort of more dogmatic, foundational instauration. So a hypothesis maybe even slips by decisionism in a certain way. Something else is going on. You see what I mean? At the same time, you're absolutely right. And that's where I try to insert some of my energy or energize these questions. Because in a lot of rather authoritative and authoritarian discursive formations, it's considered that the test or testability suffices to explain or rub out some sort of history of thought. And where I try to intervene in a certain way is to say, but the test has not been questioned in these assertions and decisions. What is testability? What kind of hidden metaphysics is lurking there? And what is it dependent on without necessarily showing its ID and so on and so forth? So I'm throwing open certain questions, and yours would belong to that region of questioning. Now, a hypothesis, I don't know if it has a signature. Sometimes it does. Very famous ones do. But Husserl says that a hypothesis, even if it's proven wrong, still retains its character as hypothesis. You can't erase it, in a sense, even if it was wrong. Right, and I'm exactly working with that, which is to say the testing velocities and implications of the sort that don't yield results, or that just really destroy world in a certain Nietzschean way. So there are, there's also what happens, if I can turn it around for a moment, when there's not a test. Let's stay within the result world. For example, in the first phase of the interminable Gulf War, when a lot of soldiers came back with Gulf War syndrome, there was no testability for that. In other words, it couldn't be their illness could not be identified, or certain types of hepatitis haven't yet been identified. So there won't be a test result, but more than that, it won't be seen to exist. So certain things can't even be brought into existence unless there's a test for them. That is something that has interested me, especially as concerns certain illnesses that get tagged onto hysterics or women or wimpy soldiers who can't hack it anymore, and so on and so forth. So when there's not a test for something, for some sort of default or deficiency or failure of the body or of world, it can't be said to exist. So that interested me as well, when there are no results because there are no tests. But I'm also working with a test that disrupts our notion of results, and a test that a relation to test, a relation to world that depends on certain regimes of testing that I explore. So you're right, there's two types, at least.
One last question.
Well, a quick comment and then a question. First off, just to say that when we test hypotheses in the life sciences, you never can accept a hypothesis. There's no such thing as acceptance of a hypothesis. You only reject or fail to reject it.
Right.
You're reminding me of how strange that language is.
Mm-hmm. This is something that that I'm questioning, and I'm very aware of the generosity of work that's gone into all sorts of researches and so on and so forth. I'm asking philosophical questions of a sort that would account for the devitalization of certain scientific procedures and the relation to the lab, which I do try to work with, beginning with a guy, I don't know, do you know Reinberger? See, he's done some very important work with protein syntheses and the grammatology of the lab and what gets framed and so on and so forth. So there is no doubt that that there are extremely important innovations, and those aren't, however, the ones that are, let's say, donating all sorts of paradigms and that enjoy a certain kind of and are a beneficiary of certain kinds of dominion that I study. Do you understand what I'm saying? If there are, let's say, progressive scientists, and there are, and so on and so forth, they're usually a minority. And then it gets very complicated, because I am talking about from Boyle to the present, to what constitutes the textual dimensions and practices and constructions of a lab. What is a lab? And I do try to trace it from the alchemist's closet to the openness of the lab, which, by the way, made allowances for women to participate very explicitly in 17th century texts. One of the very important democratizing movements of the lab is to demand repeatability, require witnessing, require all sorts of consensual determinations, and it was consciously a political upheaval to open up the labs to women and other minorities and to demand that evidence be shown. So I do try to be very careful here in this kind of wrap up of something that was done many years ago, and for many years you may get a very warped and distorted view of the immense work and discipline that I've and honoring that I've been trying to do. So I hope you don't walk away with the wrong impression. But the question is also, and this is, what allows W on the eve of 9/11 to come out and say, our nation is being tested? And how do you read that? How does someone trained in deconstructive rhetorical hermeneutic anxiety and suspicion understand that? And I try to show how he, from all of these traditions and disciplines and so on, how he's scrambling the codes. Because on the one hand, you have, in this case, we're being tested. This is the Old Testament. It also means that when W says this, when the President of the United States says we're being tested, he means he's already passed the test. But that is not the nature of testing in the way that we need to understand it, according to all of these disciplinarian contributions. So I wanted to show also the pernicious usage in a rhetorical sense and the different translocations and dislocations of testing that even go on in a political unconscious, in a certain way. Why is 9/11, and why does it remain inscribed as a test for this nation? And how does one respond to a test? And what kind of tests are there? If we're going to revert to the Old Testament, there's little Job, who really changed the nature of the test by being the first to be contestatory. So if there's ever a little big mouth who comes to your office hours and says, you gave me the wrong grade for my test, that's Job showing up, and saying, wait a minute, So there are different kinds of tests with Abraham, with the guy on the cross, and so on, and different kind of tests, and tricks, and false testing, and so on and so forth. So I'm not needed in the fields where people are doing work in good faith and strongly and powerfully and importantly. I'm needed in places where there's indecency and corruption and forgetting of certain filtering of history. You see, so I'm my way of making revolution. That's an old term. Is to go with the big guns and work with them and kind of stay up in their faces. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think it's now time to let Avital breathe a little, but you have her books here and you're welcome to chat with her. And again, thank you very much, Avital.
Thank you, Eduardo.
Thank you.
Thank you.